when we moved to Tribeca, Edward Albee was our neighbor and came to dinner. And I once made whipped cream in the kitchen. My mother always made pot de creme for dessert, and I was making the whipped cream. And Edward Albee was standing in the kitchen criticizing my whipped cream and saying that I should add more vanilla. And I said, "Oh, Edward, I don't tell you how to write plays, so you shouldn't tell me how to make whipped cream."
It's Shelf Life. Spunky young girls dominate the book choices of my guest for this episode. She is Jennifer Bell, the author of 5 savagely funny novels, and her book choices are Kay Thompson's Eloise and Charles Portis's True Grit. Find out how those heroines have shaped the 14-year-old protagonist at the heart of Bell's new novel, Swanna in Love, after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Passengers aboard the Dutch cruise ship tied to the deadly Hanta virus outbreak are making their way back to their home countries for evaluation. The vessel arrived near Spain's Canary Islands today, where public health officials coordinated medical screenings and charter flights for people leaving the ship. NPR's Miguel Macias reports.
The MV Hondius cruise ship arrived early Sunday at a seldom-used port in Tenerife, the largest island of the archipelago. It did not dock, and it will remain at a distance. Medical staff are evaluating passengers on board, who will then be transported in small groups to the port, from there to the airport, about 10 minutes away, where they will be flown to their countries of origin. Authorities are reporting none of the passengers are showing symptoms. The first group to disembark are 14 Spanish citizens who will be flown to Madrid. The complex operation involving the Spanish army and 2 national ministries has caused a political firestorm in Spain, with the central government taking measures to overrule the opposition of local authorities. Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
Several Republican-led states in the South are moving towards changing their congressional maps. They hope to give Republicans the edge in midterm elections this fall. In South Carolina, lawmakers are considering a new map intended to give the Republicans all the state's 7 seats in the House of Representatives, including the one now held by Democrat Jim Clyburn.
"I'm going to run, irrespective of what the makeup of the district might be, because I believe that I have a record that is very acceptable to the South Carolina voter, and I have a good understanding of America's promise, and we'll run on that."
He was interviewed on CNN. Prices are up, but people are still spending for mom, $25 more than they did last year. The National Retail Federation projects total spending to reach a record $38 billion this Mother's Day. NPR's Amy Held has more on the story.
Per-person planned spending is $284 on average. Mother's Day is the busiest day of the year for restaurants. Beyond brunch, there are cards and jewelry, but the top gift, 3/4 of shoppers say they're getting flowers. The thorn? Price. Up more than 7% in recent weeks. Hit by tariffs and fuel costs, many flowers are flown in, then moved in refrigerated trucks. To adapt, Eric Luoma, a florist in Scottsdale, Arizona, says he's getting creative with happy hour sales and partnering with local growers.
"We're just trying to keep things affordable for our customers because we want to keep people buying flowers."
Sellers say they're looking to flourish in other ways, offering grab-and-go bouquets and smaller arrangements. Amy Held, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Search teams in Indonesia today found the bodies of 2 hikers missing since a volcano erupted Friday. They were buried under deep, densely packed volcanic material about 165 feet from the rim of the main crater. The body of a 3rd hiker was located yesterday. They were among 20 hikers who set out to climb Mount Ukono in defiance of safety restrictions. In a world where you can gamble on almost anything, some like to bet on the time ice will break on an Alaskan river. Scientists are paying attention, too. As Shelby Herbert reports, the guessing game provides an important climate data point.
The Nenana Ice Classic clock stopped on Monday night when a tripod balanced on the river ice tipped over. The game signals the arrival of summer and has gone on for over a century. Alaskan climatologist Martin Stufer says that's why it's a valuable data point.
It's very seldom that you have a homogeneous, continuous, long-term climate series. We can see a tendency to earlier breakups.
Still, he says scientists can't use the data to predict river ice breakup down to the minute. Otherwise, he would have won at some point. For NPR News, I'm Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks.
Just in time for Mother's Day, the Social Security Administration has released the list of the most popular baby names in 2025. Olivia leads for the girls for the seventh year in a row. Charlotte is in second place, ending Emma's six-year run in that spot. She's now third. On the boys' side, Liam is number one, also for the seventh year in a row, followed by Noah and Oliver. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
I once made whipped cream in the kitchen. My mother always made pot de creme for dessert, and I was making the whipped cream. And Edward Albee was standing in the kitchen criticizing my whipped cream and saying that I should add more vanilla. And I said, "Oh, Edward, I don't tell you how to write plays, so you shouldn't tell me how to make whipped cream."
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. What does Charles Portis's 1968 novel, True Grit, twice made into a Hollywood Western, have in common with Kay Thompson's whimsical children's book, Eloise? Well, you may ask, but here to tell us is Jennifer Bell, the author of five novels, including most recently Swanna in Love, an indelible and often very funny portrait of a 14-year-old girl trapped in an artist's commune in Vermont with her bohemian mother and her mother's alcoholic lover. Swanna is desperate to get back to New York, and that's when things get dark and complicated. Bell is no novice at crafting novels that push readers outside their comfort zone. She came to fame in 1996 with Going Down, a novel that told the story of a college student who turned to prostitution to pay her tuition fees. That novel was optioned by Madonna and put Bell on the map as a funny and fearless new voice in fiction. She has said, "We laugh out loud when we deeply relate, and often that's to somebody's pain. So the way to be funny is to be honest and to talk about your pain." Jennifer Bell, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you so much, Aaron. It's just an incredible pleasure to be here with you.
I want to come back to my intro there because I wonder what kind of reactions you've had to your 14-year-old protagonist, who I found charming, funny, smart, yes, vulnerable, yes, fragile. But nevertheless, I laughed on every page. And sometimes I wondered if I should be laughing.
Well, what I found, I think, is that she's not alone. A lot of women, I think, have had experiences like she had, maybe not as extreme. I had experiences like she had, but not as extreme, admittedly. What I've found, to my surprise, actually, is women telling me stories of similar experiences to Swanna.
We've known each other quite a long time. I first came across your work when I was an editor at a magazine in New York in the early aughts. It might have been 2002 or 2003. The book was High Maintenance, about a realtor in New York City coming out of a divorce. I saw you most recently, though, at the Harvard bookstore in Cambridge. That was in February. I was lucky enough to catch you reading from Swannar and Love. This is your first book in 13 years. I wonder what it's been like to be back on the road after such a long time. The publishing industry surely has changed in that time.
Everything's changed, and I've changed a lot. And now I'm just determined to enjoy everything. And that's what's really different for me is I'm really trying to take it in. I'm having so much fun, and I'm getting an incredible kick out of reading from my book again and talking about books again and being interviewed again. It's been a long time, and I like it.
When you say you've changed, how have you changed, and what's changed about the publishing industry?
Well, the publishing industry has completely changed. I mean, now it is all about sales and political correctness and making things comfortable for everybody. I mean, since when is a writer's job to make you comfortable, or a teacher's job, or anybody's job? It's just a different world out there. Readers are different. Readers contact you on the internet instantly, and it's kind of great. I'm constantly in conversation about my book with people who have only just read it, or people who haven't read it yet just want to know about it. So it's just a very immediate world, a very different world. And I'm not as concerned about what's coming next for me, or if I'm getting enough money, or if I look good. I'm just enjoying that I wrote this book and hoping so much that people like it.
Well, it's interesting that you touched there on the publishing industry's need to provide books that are comforting for their readers. That's never been your kind of designated space in the publishing industry. I mean, your books are wonderful, but you never quite know whether you should be laughing or crying.
Or calling the police.
Yeah, or maybe doing all three things at the same time. Swannar in Love is no exception. It's got this vivid, unforgettable protagonist, Swannar Swain, at the heart of it. I wonder if we can just start by giving our listeners a flavor of the novel. There's a lovely section where mother and daughter take part in a yoga class at the artist commune in Vermont, where Swannar has been dragged against her will. I wonder if you could read from that.
Yes, I would love to. Right before the summer, my mother had decided to take adult ballet on Saturdays, and afterwards always told me how she had no idea how I could remember all those combinations because she would just stand there confused. Adult ballet was the most pathetic thing on this earth. I always looked in on them on my way to advanced intermediate and swore I would never be one of them. They all stood trying to suck in their stomachs and do a plié in fifth. They didn't even bother to put their hair in buns half the time, and their elastics were all sewed in wrong in their ballet shoes. I didn't know which was worse, the moms who took adult beginner or the ones sitting in the hall digging around in their purses for grapes in plastic baggies or quarters for the juice machine. Now, what is this called? Kumumu yoga, my mother said. Kundalini, I said. The name was written on a sign, Kundalini Yoga with Shura. If my mother didn't know a word, she just made up any word to put in its place. A few other people were setting up near us, and I had just decided to leave when a woman who was clearly Shura, wearing white baggy pants and a white tunic and a lot of white material wrapped in a turban around her head, stood at the front of the room right in front of me and my mother. For some reason, I had assumed this was the back of the room, which was why I had chosen it. I looked down at my left arm. There was a small patch of skin on the upper part of my arm that was exactly like my father's skin. It was freckled and fairer than the rest of my body. Every single time I looked down at my left arm, I thought of him because I was reminded he was part of me. Just lie on your back in Savasana with your eyes closed and breathe, the woman said. Corpse pose. So morbid, my mother whispered. I lay on my back and closed my eyes and took a deep breath. It was hard to breathe deeply when the person next to you reeked of pot and was dressed like Gelsey Kirkland. It was so embarrassing. We will begin with a 5-minute meditation. Please sit up straight. The woman hit two tiny cymbals together that were attached by a leather string. I hope there's some exercise involved in this, my mother whispered to me loudly. The teacher chimed the cymbals an annoying amount of times and then just smiled at us as people stirred and shifted behind me. "This is my daughter," my mother announced, my whole body tensed in horror. "Oh, this must be Swana. I've heard all about you. I was raised that way, doing yoga with my mother in the commune. It was just natural. Just looking at you all, I know everything about your bodies. For instance, I can tell just by looking at you how each and every one of you likes to make love." I felt myself blush, and in my discomfort, I accidentally turned my head and made eye contact with my mother, who had never looked so pleased. I thought of Dennis shaking on top of me. I thought of him holding my knees in his hands. "We're all unique," the teacher said, "but you, mother and daughter, are built just the same. You make love the same way." Everyone in the class, the six or seven other women, was staring at me. Everything that happened at this place was horrible. I could not believe this. The creepy teacher kept smiling at me. I wondered if she could tell that I had done it. I knew that was impossible. Even a doctor probably couldn't tell, or the next boy I had sex with. So far, the way I liked to make love was through my jeans, straddling a guy in a fancy car. I doubted that was how my mother liked to do it. I shuddered thinking of her disgusting boyfriend and his gross truck. I started to get a little turned on thinking about Dennis. I had to get out of this class and call him. "Okay, to open our hips for lovemaking and in honor of Swana, let's start with swan pose," the teacher said. "I have to go," I said. "I hope I didn't embarrass you," the teacher said, but I was already out of there and everyone was flapping around on the ground getting their hips open.
I have to say, I was cringing throughout reading that and then again through hearing it. There's so much in that passage. I mean, Swana Swain's precociousness, yes, her particular voice, this affected air of cynicism, the humiliation of this whole enterprise of the yoga, mother-daughter yoga session. It treads this very fine line between being, in a sense, an entertainment, but also a kind of cautionary tale. You don't disguise the fact that young adolescent girls have sexuality and know it in a way that I think young adolescent boys probably do not. So that's not the issue. It's not that she's sexually aware. It's that older men sense it and take advantage of it. I wonder how difficult it was to bring this work to a publishing house and have it published in this environment now.
Well, this is a very strange time in publishing. I work with a lot of writers who are in the editing process, and publishers actually give writers a list of words that they can't use. And I'm so amazed by this, that there are words writers aren't allowed to use. I mean, if they take away our words, what do we have left? It's just a very strange time to be a writer. So this was a crazy thing to write about, you know, and my kids are always saying, "You're going to get canceled. You're going to get canceled. You're going to get canceled." And I'm always saying to them, the only person who can cancel you is you. And then I started thinking, I'm going to get canceled, you know, and they're going to be right. And the last thing you want is for your kids to be right. That's for sure. So I was very concerned, and I thought that a lot of publishers would be interested, but that they might want me to make changes. And instead, what I found is that they didn't even want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. I mean, they didn't even want to go on record of saying anything about it, except that they liked me and they liked the writing. So then I found a publisher who wasn't scared and who wanted to go for it.
Tell me a little about Akashic's embrace of this book and how that came about.
Well, it was interesting because Johnny Temple is a publisher who I followed since he started Akashic decades ago. He's garnered a lot of respect over the years. He's done a lot of great books. And he said to me that he was interested in the book, but he wanted to know my position on the moral dilemma posed in the book. It's about a 14-year-old girl having a love affair with a married dad, a 38-year-old married dad. So I actually took that very seriously, and I called a friend of mine who's the head of the gender study department of a university, who's sort of in the thick of all this political correctness all the time. And with her help, I composed a statement using words that I usually don't use, like agency. Because what I wanted to say is that while she clearly is a victim, she's only 14 and doesn't know any better, she doesn't feel like one. This book takes place in 1982, before seatbelts, before a lot of things, when parenting was very different and when life was very different. And the book takes place over 8 days. So your character doesn't have a lot of time for self-reflection. And so what I said in this statement was, she is a victim, but she really doesn't feel like one. And that's very, very important to take in when you're reading this book, I think.
Your own mother is the poet and novelist Jill Hoffman. She, like you, has also taught workshops, something of a bohemian. I'm wondering how much of her is in Swana and Love and how much of you.
Well, there's a lot of me and a lot of my childhood and a lot of my mother. But my mother, like any mother would, was not thrilled about this book. And so sadly, I changed the mother a bit. So a little of the tenderness, some of the tender details and memories were stripped away because they were too similar to my own mother. And through my fictionalizing her, a little of the love is lost, maybe.
I want to take you back, since we're on the subject of your relationship with your mother, to New York in the 1970s and 1980s. You were young then. I'd love to get a sense of what it was like to live in this pretty dynamic sounding family at a time when New York was a very different city. What was the city like then, and what was it like for you living there?
Well, my mother was a poet, and she had been a teacher at Brooklyn College, and she was laid off in the famous budget cuts of the 70s. And she shared an office with the father of the writer Noah Baumbach.
Wow.
Who wrote the movies The Squid and the Whale. And when I saw The Squid and the Whale in the movie theater, knowing nothing about it, I sobbed my guts out for the entire film. I had to see it again because I cried so hard I could not even see it. It was like my own childhood brought to life. So if you've seen Squid and the Whale, that was my childhood in the 70s, except that was in Brooklyn and I was in Manhattan. I went to Hunter. My father was the philosophy chairman at Lehman College. We went to a lot of poetry readings, some theater. We lived for a year in London when I was a kid because my mother won a Guggenheim and my father took a sabbatical. And they decided they would write a novel together for a year. We summered on Cape Cod. It was a very typical bohemian Upper West Side childhood. And then my mother moved to Tribeca before Tribeca had any restaurants or stores. It was a wasteland and a very strange place to live. And my father moved to the heart of McDougal Street in the Village, and I had never even been downtown before. I mean, that was complete culture shock for me.
Jennifer, one of the impressions I get of your childhood through Swana is that it was a very literary world. Swana's home is kind of like a literary salon. I think Edward Albee makes an appearance, various poets, John Ashbery. How true to your childhood are those scenes?
That's all very true. The great poet John Ashbery came to our house for dinner parties every Friday night. And his husband, David Kermani, tucked me into bed at night. And when we moved to Tribeca, Edward Albee was our neighbor and came to dinner. And I once made whipped cream in the kitchen. My mother always made pot de creme for dessert, and I was making the whipped cream. And Edward Albee was standing in the kitchen criticizing my whipped cream and saying that I should add more vanilla. And I said, "Oh, Edward, I don't tell you how to write plays, so you shouldn't tell me how to make whipped cream."
You were obviously a reader when you were a child. Were you also a writer?
Well, I kept a diary probably quite a cutting diary. And then when I was 13, my mother announced to me that she had read my diary. And I took all my diaries and I threw them down the garbage chute in my building.
Damn.
And that's one of my biggest regrets. I wish so much that I had those diaries, of course. But I still keep a diary. That's my warm-up as a writer. I sit down and I get all the boring stuff out of my head. I sort of connect to the writer inside of myself. And then I'm ready to get to work.
A great insight there into the writing practice of my guest for this episode of Shelf Life, the author Jennifer Bell. We're talking about her new book, Swanna in Love. Jennifer, your debut, Going Down, came out in 1996, a very different time for publishing. The internet had yet to shake things up. We were a long way from social media. Amazon hadn't even gone public. The blurbs for your book were a who's who of what I fondly remember as the 80s literary brat pack, Jay McInerney, Tamara Janowitz. I know I once ran into Bret Easton Ellis at one of your book parties. Even Madonna came calling to option the film rights for Going Down. It's a novel about a character, Bennington Bloom, a co-ed working her way through college as a call girl. I would love you to take us back to that period of your life. It sounds like the kind of literary event that happens far too infrequently now.
Going Down is about a hooker, and my kids recently looked me up on AI. Who is Jennifer Bell on AI? And AI said she wrote a book called Going Down about an elevator operator. I think that's hilarious, the idea that I would write a book about an elevator operator. Madonna optioned the book. I had a very famous editor named Julie Grau, who together with Cindy Spiegel started a new imprint at Penguin Putnam called Riverhead. So I think part of the reason that the book got so much attention is I was one of the very first books. I think it was me and Juno Diaz on this list, this first list from Riverhead. So a lot of people were looking at the book, and I got a lot of press. And then Madonna bought the rights. I had quite a few offers. And against a lot of people's advice, I went with Madonna, because how could I not? I just loved her so much. I was such a fan, and I wanted to, so I did it. And it was a strange time because I was pretty broke. It was a long time before I got paid. So I would go home and my electricity would be turned off and my cable would be turned off and my phone would ring. And it was Madonna just wanting to ask me if I'd seen this movie or that new movie and talk about it. She was going to be the director and I was writing the screenplay. So we worked together a bit, and it was really an exciting time.
Mm. Jennifer, I first interviewed you in, I want to say 2003, maybe even 2002, when High Maintenance came out, which was a very funny novel, loosely drawn on your own experiences as a realtor in New York. Tell me how that came about.
I lived with a man in the apartment I actually live in now, and we broke up. Somehow I struck a deal with him that he would keep the apartment and he would give me some little amount of money. And I took that money and I went to real estate school, and I sobbed in the back of my real estate class, and I started to sell real estate, and I really liked it. And then when I got the Madonna deal, there was this guy at the real estate company, a fellow broker. I was at the Corcoran Group at that time. And his name was Glenn Schiller. And I always called him Glengarry Glenn Schiller. He read about my deal in New York Magazine or something. And I walked into work on a regular day and he started screaming at me, "What are you doing here? You're a writer. Get out of here. Go to Hollywood. What do you need this dump for?" It was like a scene in a Richard Gere movie. And he went over to my desk with a garbage bag and he started throwing all the contents of my desk and my laptop and everything into these garbage bags. And he was like, "Get out. Just get out." And I thought, okay, he's right. I'm a big writer. What am I doing in this dump? And as I was walking out the door, this pathetic broker said to me, hey, you know, I left my wallet at home. Can I borrow $20? And I lent her $20 and I went out with my garbage bags. And that broker today, who I lent the $20 to, that I never got that $20 back, she went on to make so much money.
Wow.
And I went on to make very little money. I ended up showing Madonna some apartments, and we would get into her limousine and go and look at these properties. And she had a lot of requirements, like the apartment had to have a secret exit that only she could use in the building for getting in and out. And, you know, a lot of co-ops in New York don't really want Madonna to have her own exit. But I found some properties for her, and we'd get out of the limousine and all this paparazzi would just surround us, and they'd be in my face taking my picture. And then as soon as they figured out I was nobody, they would just all go away. Like, the contrast was just devastating. I think I showed her maybe 5 properties. I'd take her up into this property and I'd make some joke like, this is where my desk will be. And finally she just said, could you just stop saying that? She didn't enjoy me moving in with her joke. But if she had bought a place from me, it would have been worth a lot more than any old book career, that's for sure.
That ship may have sailed, but at least at least you're still writing books. I wonder if at times in the last 13 years you have wondered if you were ever going to publish another book. You spent so much time helping other writers birth their novels, sort of handmaiden to other people's careers. Were there moments when you just thought, that's it, I'm not going to be published again?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of pressure these days to publish a book every year or two. And I never imagined that I would do that. I mean, I only want to publish something if I think it's really ready and really good. And I was writing over the past 13 years a book about a literary agent in New York, but I had been shying away from this book, the book I wanted to write. I felt like I was writing, but I wasn't in any way finishing anything, and I wasn't prepared to publish anything. But recently, I was asked to write a description for a piece of art that's in a museum in Rome, and I got it into my head that I wanted to take something from a diary of mine. So I have been going through my diaries over the past few years looking for this excerpt that I actually never found. And what I found in my diaries was this, all of this writing berating myself for not having written. Why aren't you writing? Why are you doing this? You're ruining a great career. You're ruining your life. Stop this. Write. So I have a false memory of this time. I mean, I think I was writing, but my diaries say otherwise.
So I wanted to talk about one of your students in particular, and that's Janine Cummins. Her book, American Dirt, caused a bidding war. It was endorsed by Oprah and was praised by Sandra Cisneros and Stephen King, among many others. And then there came this massive backlash, prompted in part by the way Flatiron Books marketed American Dirt, but also by a cancel culture mob, frankly, that ran Cummins out of town for the temerity of telling a story they felt was not hers to tell. Having known her so well, I think she recently hosted a conversation with you for the release of Swana in Love. I'm curious what you took away from that backlash and how and in what ways you think it's impacted publishing.
Well, I think it completely changed publishing. I don't think anything has ever impacted publishing as much as that incident with the book American Dirt. 23 publishers or something like that wanted that book, wooed her, loved the book. The book was compared to East of Eden. She was going to be the next John Steinbeck. If you went to the big book expo they have in New York at the Javits Center, there was a banner with her name on it and picture on it that went from one end of the Javits Center to the other end of the Javits Center. I mean, she was the biggest thing in publishing that you could imagine. People loved this book. It was a book about a Mexican woman who escapes Mexico, fleeing a drug cartel. And then what happened is one woman started wildly tweeting against Janine and saying that she had no right to write from the point of view of a Mexican because she was half Puerto Rican and half Irish. And this is the first time we heard that we couldn't write from somebody else's point of view. I mean, there is quite a history of women writing from the point of view of men and men writing from the point of view of women and people writing from the point of view of absolutely anyone they want to write from, as long as they could pull it off and as long as a publisher decided this is really good, this is what we're going to put out there. And this woman, Miriam, just got an army behind her of people outraged that Janine would be able to publish this book from the point of view of a Mexican woman when she wasn't Mexican. And I think her publisher worked very valiantly to try to protect her, but it was too late. Her book party and book tour had to be canceled. She had to have a friend move in with her because there were so many death threats and she was so terrified. And she is the opposite of any person who could deal with such a thing. Like, I think I could deal with something like this. I'd have to have those millions of dollars. I like to think that I'm more thick-skinned, but when I've talked to her about it, it was really bad. I mean, it was not her fault. She printed an apology in the next edition of the book, which I thought was a terrible idea. During COVID, somebody started a fund for independent bookstores to keep them open. She tried to donate an enormous amount of money, and they would not take her money. She is such a conscientious, kind, generous, lovely person who just happens to be a really good writer. You know, she's just a really good writer. That was her crime.
Right. Right.
So now there's just this terrible climate of caution and censorship and fear out there.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode is Jennifer Bell, the author most recently of Swana in Love. We'll be back after this.
Ellenville Run Like the Wind is Sunday, May 17th. Established in 1983, this 5K run and walk follows a scenic route through Ellenville, including a stretch on the newly resurfaced Braille Trail, ending with a post-race celebration at Aromatime Bistro featuring food and drinks. Proceeds benefit local food pantries, youth scholarships, and other community causes. ElenvilleRunLikeTheWind.com. Paid for by Ellenville Run Like the Wind.
Emily Amick is a Democratic influencer, and she's been telling the party to get better at online messaging for years.
Honey, you don't understand politics. You're the comms guru of the party, and you're just learning about TikTok? That's crazy.
Meanwhile, the Republican Party has a highly sophisticated online and social media operation.
Look, who doesn't love to be right? I wish I wasn't.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode is the author Jennifer Bell. We're talking about two among her favorite books. Jennifer, Eloise is the classic tale of a vivacious and mischievous six-year-old who lives in the Plaza Hotel in New York City. She actually gets name-checked in your new book, Swana in Love. How instrumental was Eloise in shaping your imagination as a kid?
Well, for this podcast, I'm allowed to make you read two books, basically. And so I wanted you to read True Grit, which I don't think you had read. And then I just wanted you to read Eloise because I couldn't decide if it should be Little Women or Little House on the Prairie. I just wanted you to talk about a little girl living at the Plaza. So that's why I chose Eloise for us to talk about. But Swana, my character Swana, is a big reader, as I was. You know, it's how I got through my childhood. I suspect it's how many of us got through our childhoods back then. That and television. I will not discount I Love Lucy, but you didn't ask for my TV recommendations. When I was writing Swana in Love from the point of view of this 14-year-old girl, I didn't have to reread anything because all of these books are such a part of me. They are my voice. They make up my voice. Catcher in the Rye is my voice, and Eloise at the Plaza is my voice, and Little House on the Prairie, it really is my voice. So it just was natural that I would reference all these books, and Eloise is a big one.
I think you should refresh our memories and recite the famous first few lines of Eloise. I have a feeling you might know it off by heart.
I do know it by heart. I am Eloise. I am six. I am a city child. I live at the Plaza.
Eloise is, of course, a child's perspective of an adult's world, much like your other book choice for this show, True Grit. I wonder if that is the kind of magic source of a kid's book for us, that it gives us the world of adults, but from a perspective that we can completely empathize with. It's our perspective, right?
Yes. Children do not care about the adult perspective ever. You know, that's why Peanuts is famous for the adults going, wah, 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 because that's what kids hear when adults talk.
One of the things that I loved about this book is, although it is from a child's perspective, it has an adult's sense of humor and wit. At one point in the drawings which accompany Kay Thompson's text, the drawings are by Hilary Knight, you see a bottle of gin on the bookcase in Eloise's bedroom. And this book is full of kind of little sort of subversions like that, isn't it?
Well, Eloise, like Swana, doesn't have a lot of parental guidance. She has a loving nanny, but she's very precocious and independent and curious. And she lives in a world of adults. She maneuvers her way around all the gin bottles and does quite well for herself. But she's also lonely and could use a mom.
What do we know about the life of Kay Thompson, the creator of Eloise? Cecil Beaton, the great photographer of mid-century celebrities and aristocrats, wrote of Kay Thompson. The facts about her are that she sings and prances in cabaret between Los Angeles and Istanbul, that she is skeletal, hatchet-faced, blonde, and American, that she wears tight, tapering slacks and moves like a mountain goat. The proper language in which to review her is not English at all, but Esperanto, or possibly Morse code. What's your understanding of Kay Thompson's life?
Well, Eloise, like Swana, was based on a real person. Eloise was a girl who grew up in the Plaza and lived this life of traveling around with her nanny. And I don't know much about her adult life. I'm sorry to hear she was skeletal. She and I certainly differ in that way.
There's a great quote I found from Kay Thompson. She said that the secret of life was, quotes, a lot of hard work, a lot of sense of humor, a lot of joy, and a lot of tra-la-la.
I didn't think we were really going to talk about Eloise, but I love that we are. You're a man of your word. You're a man of true grit.
But is that a recipe for life? I felt the sense of humor and the hard work would certainly register with you. I mean, humor seems to be a language that you deploy all the time, not only in your work, but also in your day-to-day life. It's sort of how you get through the day, isn't it?
Well, I don't think of it that way. I think of everything as very tragic, but whenever I complain, people just laugh at me. So I feel like what makes people laugh is other people's pain in a way. Like when you say something real and a person identifies or recognizes something about his own situation in what you say, a laugh comes out of you. Like I watch a Chekhov play and somebody's boo-hooing about how depressed and bleak life is. And I just laugh. I just let out a huge laugh in the audience because I so relate. So I think that what's funny is what we identify with. So yes, I think you have to have a sense of humor, but I don't ever think of myself as having one. I mean, I don't try or anything.
There is a scene in Swana and Love where she goes to Rudyard Kipling's home in Vermont. She gets hit upon by a man dressed as Rudyard Kipling. It's not only Rudyard Kipling's home. She has a whole kind of list of literary homes she's been to. I think Keats is in there and Shakespeare, Dickens. Are those actual reference points for you? Have you visited those homes?
Of course I have. That's one of the great pleasures in life is going to the home of a famous writer and soaking it in and looking at their little spectacles and the glass case and the letters that they wrote and the gun they killed themselves with and the bed they died in and the hair and the locket that their widow kept. And I mean, I love that stuff. Absolutely love it. In fact, I was just in Rome last week and the first thing I did was go to Keats' house again because I love it so much.
And describe what you love about it so much.
Well, the first time I stood in that room, I was, you know, probably 28 or so, 27. I just believed in magic. You know, I just believed that the greatness of Keats would come through the floorboards and up into my soul. And, you know, I just would become him for a moment. Now, visiting at the age of 56 with a couple of teenagers, my kids, it was a little bit less magical, I will admit. But I love that these houses exist. I mean, in a world where they're trying to kill off writers and the arts are going through a tough time, how incredible that people travel to this house in Rome where Keats died. I'm not being very articulate here, but I love these houses very much.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the author Jennifer Bell. Her new book is Swana in Love. Jennifer, let's talk about True Grit. It's a novel written by Charles Portis. It was first published in 1968. It's set in the rough and tumble world of the American frontier in the late 19th century. It's famously told through the eyes of Mattie Ross, a determined and forthright 14-year-old girl from Yell County, Arkansas, after her brother is brutally murdered by a hired hand, Tom Chaney. She embarks on a quest for justice and vengeance. I only knew this movie through the 2010 Coen Brothers remake of an earlier movie that starred John Wayne, that's probably the more famous of them. I don't think I even realized at the time that it was based on a novel. What about True Grit so appeals to you to include it in one of your favorite books today?
Well, I had never heard of it before COVID, and a friend of mine gave it to me, and it just looked absolutely terrible. I hate the name True Grit. It looks like a Western. It has a gun on the cover. I mean, there's nothing about this book that I thought I was going to like. And he convinced me I really should read this book. And from maybe the first sentence, I was transported into a place inside of myself that I just cannot even describe. I mean, it just opened up. It opened me up in a way I just don't know why. It's just so well written. The dialogue is exquisite, and it's just really brave and good and amazing.
He was a journalist for a long time before he became a novelist. He worked at the Herald Tribune. He worked in Manhattan and London.
Well, don't hold that against him. It wasn't his fault. He probably had to make money.
Well, here's the thing that I found interesting is after this incredible career in journalism, working with Lewis Lapham and Tom Wolfe, he moves back to Arkansas to write fiction full time. And he really needed to kind of be in what he described or perhaps would describe as his native soil to be able to write about this world, the world of True Grit. He couldn't have done it from New York. It made me think very much of Eudora Welty, who I read recently for the first time, who also kind of had to write very much about the world she came from in Mississippi. I wonder how important you think place is to the work you produce.
I think it's incredibly important, and I completely relate to his wanting to be in a certain house at a certain desk on a certain soil to write a certain book. And maybe that's why I love the homes of dead writers so much, because it's so interesting to imagine what they were thinking when they looked out that window. Like Melville's house, if you've never been there, the mountain out his window looks like a whale. It just absolutely looks like a whale. That was what gave him the idea to write about a whale, was that mountain that he looked out of. So I completely understand being sensitive to where you are, but I'm very sensitive to where I write, and it's important to me.
Jennifer, why don't we hear a short excerpt from True Grit? I think you might have found something earlier today to read for this episode.
I'd just like to say I think it's incredibly unfair to have me read from my own book and then read from one of the greatest books ever written, and have so little time to choose the perfect excerpt. But really, it doesn't matter, because anywhere you open this book, it's just brilliant. Rooster was one of the last ones out. He had a paper in one hand and a sack of tobacco in the other, and he was trying to roll a cigarette. His hands were shaking and he was spilling tobacco. I approached him and said, "Mr. Rooster Cogburn?" He said, "What is it?" His mind was on something else. I said, "I would like to talk with you a minute." He looked me over. "What is it?" he said. I said, "They tell me you are a man with true grit." He said, "What do you want, girl? Speak up. It is supper time." I said, "Let me show you how to do that." I took the half-made cigarette and shaped it up and licked it and sealed it and twisted the ends and gave it back to him. It was pretty loose because he had already wrinkled the paper. He lit it and it flamed up and burned about halfway down. I said, "Your makings are too dry." He studied it and said, "Something." I said, "I am looking for the man who shot and killed my father, Frank Ross, in front of the Monarch boarding house. The man's name is Tom Cheney. They say he is over in the Indian Territory, and I need somebody to go after him." He said, "What is your name, girl? Where do you live?" "My name is Maddie Ross," I replied. "We are located in Yell County near Dardanelle. My mother is at home looking after my sister Victoria and my brother, little Frank." "You had best go home to them," said he. "They will need some help with the churning." I said, "The high sheriff and a man in the marshal's office have given me the full particulars. You can get a fugitive warrant for Tom Cheney and go after him. The government will pay you $2 for bringing him in, plus 10 cents a mile for each of you. On top of that, I will pay you a $50 reward." "You have looked into this right smart," said he. "Yes, I have," said I. "I mean business." He said, "What have you got there in your poke?" I opened the sugar sack and showed him. "By God," said he, "a Colt's Dragoon? Why, you are no bigger than a corn nubbin. What are you doing with that pistol?" I said, "It belonged to my father. I intend to kill Tom Cheney with it if the law fails to do so."
That was Jennifer Bell reading there from one of the greatest books ever written, in her own words.
Yes.
One of the great things about True Grit is not only that it has this fantastic female protagonist, but even his male characters, they're not typical of the genre. They don't seem as toxic as a lot of, you know, male characters of that era as we're used to. They seem pretty gallant.
So tender, really. So gallant and so human and so three-dimensional, as is this 14-year-old girl, Maddie Ross. And I said to someone that it's really a love story, even though there's no sex or any kind of real romance. There is real love in this book. And the person I said that to wholeheartedly disagreed and thought that was absurd. But I feel that it's very clear that she loves this bounty hunter and he loves her.
Why did that friend think it absurd? What was their counterpoint?
Because he thinks it's a Western where people are going after a murderer and there are snakes and Indians and real bad guys and lots of whiskey.
Charles Portis died at 86, only a few years ago. He didn't write for the last 25, 28 years of his life. We've been talking a little about Holden Caulfield and kind of parallels with Swanna Swain. J.T. Salinger also didn't write for a vast stretch of his life.
I don't know if he stopped writing. He stopped publishing.
Right.
You know, we don't want to just publish anything. I mean, these days, people are on this insane trajectory or schedule of a book a year. I mean, publishers really want a book a year or a book every 2 years, and that's not normal. That's not right. A book takes a long time to write, and it should. I don't want you to read something that I wrote in 5 minutes. That's crazy. But I don't know. I don't know if he was writing or not, but he wasn't publishing, and I don't know why. And maybe he couldn't get published. You know, a lot of times people can't get published.
Right. Right. I think that's more of the story probably since the late 90s, is that what used to be called the mid-list, which was writers that did very well, but maybe they weren't bestsellers, that the publishing houses that used to nurture that kind of mid-list have gone, you know, subsumed into bigger publishing houses. And there aren't the sort of publisher, editor, owner figures that used to actually care about their authors and take them to lunch. Is that something that you've experienced?
Absolutely. Of course I have. And so have so many people I know. I mean, I know some really wonderful, famous writers who had hits who are getting rejected left and right. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, but I don't know how it's possible. But they're not getting published. So, and that could have very easily happened to me. When you step away from something for 13 years, you're not relevant anymore at all. So I was very lucky that this book was taken, and I'm just so happy that I did this. You know, I'm just so happy that I took this risk and did it anyway, even though I knew the odds were not good.
I mean, it's such a great book, Jennifer. I finished it last night at 4 a.m. It's not often I want to stay up that late to read a book, not only because I had to, but also because it was such a pleasure to read. Swanna's voice is so distinctive and compelling and charming and vulnerable. I felt that you were fearless in reminding us that Swanna is a victim of an older man in many ways, but she also understands her sexuality. She understands how potent it is. I think a lot of writers would have been tempted to sort of rein some of that in.
Well, thank you so much for saying these nice things about the book. I wasn't conscious of these choices so much, but I was very supported by my writing workshop when I was writing this, because I'd bring in these very sexual scenes between this young girl and this older guy. And I have a wide range of people in the workshop, including some quite politically correct younger people who I was very shocked were going with it. Yes, she is a victim because she is a child, but she doesn't feel that way. She really doesn't for those 8 days. The book takes place over 8 days in 1982. And for those 8 days, she thinks she's in love and she thinks she's having the time of her life with this guy. And I was pretty concerned when it came to really publishing it. I thought, is this palatable? Is this okay? Am I hurting people even? It was people like you and people who read early drafts who liked her and believed in her and felt that it was a worthwhile voice, because this is how girls really are sometimes.
Right. Jennifer Bell, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Shelf Life.
Well, thank you so much for saying these nice things about the book. It means so much to me, and so happy that you like it.
We've been talking about True Grit, published by the Overlook Press, and Eloise, published by Simon & Schuster. Jennifer Bell's new book, Swanna in Love, is published by Akashic. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Gram Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. If you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, with guests such as Ramit Sethi, John Waters, Sarah Waters, and Kevin Barry. And while you're there, push the boat out and give us a 5-star rating. It will help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Greetings and salutations, theater fans. It's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I'm joined by Brendan Burke and Ben Williamson of Shadowland Stages for an in-depth conversation about the theater's ambitious 2026 lineup, the creative process behind building a year of plays and musicals, and just what it takes to sustain professional live theater in our community. That's Monday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.